it's a 10 team. It's better than one. I like it. 10 is better.
All right, good evening. Back to chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians.
Starting over.
Come on, man. We're not going to be on chapter 1 until probably October. No. try to do a little better. But I do, you know, a little bit of intentionality. Intend to spend a little bit more time in these earlier chapters, simply because as I was, hopefully more or less successfully communicating last week, despite the way that we historically, a lot of us like to look at 1 Corinthians episodically, you know, right, where we go to chapter 5 for, you know, sleeping with your dad's wife is a bad thing to do, or, you know, chapter 6 for church discipline, or things like that. There is a larger argument, a larger perspective that undergirds all of what Paul is about. He is dealing with their particular issues or their particular questions. But there is a deeper bit of change of mind, change of heart that he's after, and very skillfully ties the whole book together. And so you can stop to think about it. He opens the book with divisiveness. You know, I'm a Paul, I'm a Cephas, I'm a Apollos, this divisiveness. And he deals with part of why they're divided. He deals with, the fact that they're impressed with eloquence. And of course, Paul wasn't that eloquent. He admits as much elsewhere. But they're picking favorites based on shallow and silly reasons. And he leaves it alone for a while after criticizing it. But then we stop and think about when you get late in the book, chapters 12, 13, and 14. What's he back to talking about again, though we usually focus on the spiritual gifts issue? But what's he actually dealing with? The spiritual gifts were just a pretext to what?
Quarreling amongst themselves
and dividing themselves, because now instead of ranking themselves based on who liked what preacher, they were ranking themselves based on
who has the best gift.
Yeah, and just like we were evaluating the apostles and evangelists of the first century incorrectly, were they evaluating even the value of the gifts in terms of what's actually truly spiritually most beneficial? Yes, they were misvaluing those as well. Why? For the same reasons talked about right back here in the early chapters. You're thinking in worldly terms, not in fundamentally spiritual terms. And so it's worth spending some time in these first four chapters to just absorb beyond the surface, what he's really pushing at. And what he's trying to get across. Because the truth of the matter is he really is a wise master builder, as he calls himself elsewhere in this book. He knows what he's doing. The spirit helps out a little bit, I'm sure. But there is a method to his madness. And there's something that goes beyond just saying, hey, quit being shallow. And again, don't sleep around and practice church discipline and things like that. There's more to it. And so we want to get to the transformational level. We do want to kind of get to this larger, what he's pushing at. And a lot of that heavy lifting is done in these first four chapters. That's where a lot of this is happening. So let's start with a word of prayer, and then we'll get back to the text. Who wants to lead us in that tonight? Volunteers. Thank you.
Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to study your word. We ask that you would be with us, help Jeff as he guides us in this study. Be with us always is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.
All right. So let's start that. Let's go back to chapter 1. I'm going to pick up in verse 18, and let's just read kind of the section that we'll spend some time with tonight. That starts at verse 18, and because chapter breaks are usually in the wrong place, we're going to go into chapter 2 just a little bit, the first few verses, okay? For, and why is he saying this? Because that word for means he's connected back to something, right? And what he's connecting back to is really all about the above, but we can really just use verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Now, these people understood intellectually that, Jesus died for their sins, that's why they were baptized, that's why they're recognized as Christians. They understand that intellectually, but they do not understand the implications, the worldview, they don't understand what's underneath that, right? And so now, for, verse 18, he's going to go on this multiverse, I don't want to call it a digression, but this multiverse explanation of the power of the cross. Because what you've done is emptied it of that. Not because that you can literally do that, but the way they're thinking, they're living, they're dividing among themselves. They have, practically speaking, how they're living. The cross has been emptied of its power, of its implications, and it's not changing their lives. And again, one of the big takeaways we mentioned last week, you can be intellectually correct, be recognized as a Christian, but still be spiritually of the world. He wasn't saying that this wasn't an actual Church of Christ. He was not saying these people weren't Christians. But what he was saying is, you guys have completely missed the boat. You got the technical details correct, but spiritually you're still completely off the reservation, which is why you're asking me the questions you're asking me and why you're doing the things that you're doing that Chloe told on you for. Okay? So, for the word of the cross, and the word that just means the message, the essence, the thing itself, both in terms of what it literally was, you know, Jesus was crucified, and what it represented. The word of the cross is folly or foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, and there you might put its wisdom, its own wisdom, it pleased God through the folly or foolishness of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, which is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jew and Greek, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to the worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, so that, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. And so when I came to you, brothers, I didn't come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or worldly wisdom. For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And so I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. And my speech and my message were not implausible words of worldly wisdom, but a demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And what has happened for the past 2,000 years is we have tried to mingle the power of God with the wisdom of men. It still happens today. You can see that in some of the commentaries you pick up and read about the Bible. You can see that when the world tries to say Jesus was a good man and a good teacher, but he didn't really work miracles because he wasn't really divine. And so on and so forth. You can see it when people reason away what Jesus taught that is unpopular in our times, like divorce and remarriage, or like homosexuality. There's always been this desire or this push to mingle the cross with the world. And so there's nothing new about that. But if you don't push back on it and intentionally push back on it, and Paul's giving us the tools here to push back on it correctly, then you wind up with a church that looks like Corinth eventually. If not lives that look like Corinthian lives. Okay? And so that's always been the challenge. Let's go back and let's unpack a little bit what he's up to. Because part of what drives this section is he's got two quotations from the Old Testament. I threw them up on the board last week, told you if you want some reading to do this week, besides reading the first four chapters, you know, you can go back and read Isaiah 29 and Jeremiah chapter 9, where those things come from. And so we'll get to that in just a sec. Verse 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. Now, what's fascinating is most English translations put that in the active sense, those who are perishing, but literally in Greek it's not. It's those who are being destroyed, those who are being perished. It's not what they are doing themselves, it's what's being done to them. In other words, you're already under God's judgment, you just don't even know it. They are being destroyed, but they're too blind and too foolish to even realize it. And why would Paul phrase it that way? Well, a lot of why he would phrase it that way, those are perishing, or those who are being destroyed, but those who are being saved is the power of God. For it is written, here's the reason I said what I said in verse 18, because it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. All right, so let's go back. He gets that from Isaiah chapter 29. And one of the things you've got to learn about Paul, some of you have heard this before because you've been through this dance with me before, but maybe you haven't, or maybe it's been long you've forgotten. Paul rarely just cherry picks a line of proof texts. He's almost always invoking a context. He's invoking a larger thought, something bigger going on than just... Now, the words he cites are the key point he wants, but again, there's some unpacking to be done because he is pulling in... he's pulling in usually something larger from the context. So let's go back to Isaiah 29 and see why Paul picked that opening in the prophets there, right? So I'm going to go back to Isaiah chapter 29 and... let's see. Let's pick up, for sake of time. Yeah, it's going to be there, but I'm just trying to see how far back I want to go. Yeah, I did, didn't I? So let's go ahead and start there. Let me say this much. We'll start in verse 9. That's right. But part of what's going on in Isaiah's own day, you go back to chapter 7, he's had to deal directly with King Ahaz. And you remember, one of the things that Ahaz is afraid of is invasion. He's afraid because he knows that his enemies to the north want to replace, they don't want to destroy it, they want to replace him with a puppet king so that basically, Jerusalem will pay tribute, and in particular that Jerusalem will then be willing to help some other countries, most notably Samaria and Syria, fight against Assyria. And so they were wanting to form a military coalition. Ahaz didn't want any part of that. And so instead they were going to do was invade and take out Jerusalem, not with the purpose of destroying, but with the purpose of deposing Ahaz. So he was scared. And you remember part of what he wants to do. He wants to form a military alliance. With who? With Egypt. What should he have done instead? And what was Isaiah's actual mission when he went to talk to Ahaz? What was the message that Isaiah was tasked by God to give to Ahaz?
Turn to God.
Yeah, don't turn to Egypt, turn to who? Turn to me and I will deliver you. And the counterpoint to this, if you've been through Isaiah, which I think we did just a quarter or two ago, the counterpoint that Ahaz is in Isaiah 36 to 39. Hezekiah is then invaded not by just weaker nations, he's invaded by Assyria itself, who has already taken out Samaria. So it's gotten real, and it's gotten real close to home for him. And when literally Assyria is at the gates of Jerusalem saying basically surrender or die, and literally in the hearing of all the people, does he speak in Aramaic so that everybody can hear? Don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Your God hasn't delivered anybody else. No God has delivered anybody from the Assyrian king. And so what you really need to do is get rid of Hezekiah, submit or die. And what does Hezekiah do? Does he immediately send a telegram to Egypt? Anybody remember the story? What does he do? He prays. And in particular, where does he even literally go? Because he's in Jerusalem, after all. He goes to the temple, and he falls down on his face before God. And he says, God, you hear what they're saying about you? What are you going to do about that? Anybody remember the story? One of the great miracles in the Bible. Anybody remember what God's answer is?
180,000 like this.
Yeah, one angel, Assyrian army gone, point made. And so, that's the whole issue is, are you going to live life by the world standards, or are you going to live a life of faith and dependence that goes against all conventional wisdom of the world? That's one of the basic issues that the prophet Isaiah is dealing with and the kings that he is sent to work with. Okay? So that kind of hangs overall. Does that make sense? Why did kings, Jewish kings turn to Egypt or turn to military alliances? Because that's what worldly advice and worldly wisdom and all your PhDs from Johns Hopkins and Georgetown who have been to the School of Foreign Service tell you to do. Prayer doesn't solve this. I got you. Prayer doesn't solve this. Real world solutions, real politic. And what are the Corinthians doing? They're thinking exact same level. All right, go ahead, Lyndon.
Can't help but think of the blaring example of the parallel of what sounds good to society versus even what's considered factual whether it be via experience or whether it's what's gone through what we think of as a scientific method.
Right.
There's definitely some parallels going in
oh, sure.
here, and I don't want to go too deep into the subject, but
of
I
course.
Just, it's screaming at me because I'm going, they've seen this historically, and we've seen other things historically, but people will gravitate towards what sounds good in the immediate.
Especially when they're afraid.
Yeah.
Especially when, that's exactly right. And that's why those are moments of spiritual testing for people, because you find out what your God actually is. And you find out what you really trust or believe in. And so back to the actual context that Paul is in Isaiah, I'll pick up at verse 9, as I've been admonished and reminded. Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, but not with wine. Stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes, the prophets, and covered your heads, the seers. All right, stop right there for a second. So here's part of the frightening thing. This is, again, a theme that runs all through the Bible, which is God actually knows what's in your mind and your heart, what you really want. And so what God's going to do is put you in situations sometimes where it's still your choice. But God's going to put you in situations where the choice that you make reveals what's really in your heart, what you really are, what you really want, what you really trust in, and so forth. Does that make sense? You always have the choice. But God will allow you, and so that's what he says I'm going to do. Okay, I gave Ahaz a choice back in chapter 7. What choice did Ahaz make? And did he make it? He made the wrong choice, but did he make it in really religious languages? Oh, I won't put God to the test and ask for a sign. Oh, yeah. He sounded really good. Sounded spiritual, but God knew what was really underneath that. He didn't want to ask, he didn't want to take God up on ask for a sign to get some comfort right now, because what did he really want to do? He wanted a solution he could see. And that's called sign the papers with Egypt. So, God's ultimately reminding us, and reminding them back then, but it still works this way today, I'm going to basically blind you. I'm going to put you in a position, if this is what you really want, so that it really, you know, you go the rest of the way. You're going to make the choice, but it's going to tease out of you, you know, all these spiritual issues and this spiritual weakness and compromise that's within you. And so the vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed. So when you give it to one man who can read, it's saying, read this. He says, I cannot, for it's sealed. And when they give the book to one who cannot read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot read. And so in other words, you get to a point where, kind of like what Ahaz did back in chapter 7, when Isaiah, God through Isaiah says, ask me for a sign, man. I'm really on your side in this. But I won't put God to the test. I'm above that. You get to a point spiritually where you don't want to see. There's always a reason you don't read your Bible. There's always a reason you don't pray more. There's always a reason you don't listen to the elder's advice. There's always a rationalization or a reason or an excuse not to take up and read, not to listen to what God has said. And so that's what begins to happen in real life on the ground. And maybe you can sit there and remember some moments in your own life when you've been that person and you've made that decision. And so verse 13, the Lord said, because this people draw near with their mouth, I won't put God to the test. And they honor me with their lips. And stop right there for a second again. Is this the Corinthians? They still meeting on Sunday? They still having the Lord's Supper? I mean, I know. But are they still doing it?
Yeah.
Such as it is. Et cetera, et cetera. Are they saying all the right things and... I don't say doing all the right things, but you get what I'm fishing for here, right? Yes, they are. Nothing's changed, you know, from Isaiah's day to the Corinthians day. Nothing's changed from the Corinthians day to our day. You can talk a good game religiously. While their hearts are far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment taught by men. Therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people, with wonder upon wonder. And when I do these wonderful things, and wonderful there doesn't mean just like, you know, wonderful, happy, happy. Wonderful in the sense of things that cause wonder, things that blow your mind. Like the centurion sitting at the cross saying, wow, this was weird. This really was the Son of God. This is not even any other execution I've ever, you know, carried out. Because what things happened when Jesus was crucified? Earthquakes.
Darkness.
Dead
graves.
Yeah, dark graves. Things that might you might, things that you, might make you rethink your life choices. Wonders. And so God says, I'm going to do something. And by the way, do the heirs of the Jews of Isaiah's day, does that change their minds? The centurion was rattled by what he was a part of, but the chief priests get down on their knees and say, oh man, we blew this. No, in fact, what are they doing in the book of Acts just a couple months later when the apostles start preaching Jesus? What are they doing?
Trying to kill them.
Don't you dare bring this man's blood on us. Don't you dare put our names on this. Absolutely. So, and again, we can read this in concrete situations, but this is how God works. This is why Paul reminds the Corinthians of this. Therefore, I will again do wonderful things with this people, wonder upon wonder, and when I do these wondrous things, the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning men shall be hidden. Well, all the experts from Johns Hopkins and Georgetown, all my foreign policy advisors said we really should go with Egypt. But Hezekiah just kind of blew that up with this whole 185,000 or whatever was dead overnight. I guess we didn't need Egypt after all. So much for the wisdom of the wise. I mean, you know, that's what God does, right? He sits in the heavens and he laughs. And the problem with Christians, Corinthian or otherwise, is we lose sight of the fact that this is what God does. And so the problem is we don't want to live a cruciform life. We don't actually want to live a cross-shaped life. Because we say, I have my rights. We say, I need to make boundaries. We say, you need to stand up for yourself. And ultimately, what does Jesus do?
Lays it all down.
Lays it all down. And what does the cross say? You know, what does his embrace of the cross say about your rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What does it say about that? Or is that the wisdom of the world? It says you do right because you fear God, and you let the chips fall where they may, in terms of this world. And that's a terrifying thing. But that's the wisdom of the cross. And God says, in doing that, I blow up the wisdom of the world. How did the cross, let's think about it, you know, if this is where Paul's pushing, how does the cross blow up the world's wisdom?
And resurrection.
Well, the resurrection is part of it. Resurrection is part of it. How does the resurrection blow up the world's wisdom?
The winner doesn't die.
Come again?
The winners don't die.
Yeah.
That's weakness. That's a loss.
Okay. Flesh that a little bit more in case someone's not catching on. Well, yeah, I know what you mean.
No, yeah. So, historically speaking, the winners, the people that write history, the people that get to say what actually happened, are the people that lived to tell about it.
Right.
Right? But here, you know, the apostles preach a man who died. And not just died a humiliating death.
And that's part of this, right.
And the Romans and the leading Jews at the time, they won. By all intents and purposes, they won.
Okay.
But this story doesn't stop there, which is strange, right? Because normally you reach the death of somebody and the story's over. But God raises this person who died a humiliating death, lived a very humble, modest life, and now that person is the king?
Yeah.
How is that wisdom?
Yeah. And it's along the line, I like the way you said, you know, he's the king. Because, in fact, and by the way, Paul knows what he's doing. Is Christ the king in 1 Corinthians?
I mean, yes.
Well, but
he talks about authority.
He does talk about authority, but where does finally Christ as king and kingdom finally pop up? Chapter 15. Ironically, when he talks about
the
resurrection. And so there it is. And so that's the thing, because in the world, what worldly wisdom says is, do you wait for power to be given to you, or do you have to take power?
Take it.
You take it. And whereas Christ gets a kingdom, how?
But
by having it given to him. You know, when Matthew's version of the Great Commission there, Matthew 28, all authority has been taken by me.
Given
to me. So much for worldly wisdom. Again, all my political advisors told me that's not how you get power. Right? There's only power, and those, you know, those too weak or too afraid to use it. Someone said, well, somewhere else, maybe some movie I saw. I don't know, I just remember that. That line's always stuck with me. What a dark view of life. And so, yeah, it blows up all worldly wisdom. Because here's the thing. you know, and Eric also hit upon something else that's important. We hear the word cross, and we think about jewelry, and we think about it religiously now. That's, and some of you heard this before, but that's just simply not how it was heard back then. When you hear the word cross, you think criminal. You think sedition. You think lowest of the low, because could a Roman citizen be crucified?
No.
No. You had to be truly a nobody to be crucified. And why did, and think about it even this way, why did Rome go, first of all, why would Rome not allow its own citizens to be crucified even if they were worthy of death?
Because it's humiliating.
It's humiliating, and it was meant to be, and what else?
The law.
Say again?
The law.
Well, it's the law, yeah, but why would they have that kind of a law? Why would they exempt their own citizens from
because
it?
Because we're better than you.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so part of, yeah, we're better than you.
Even our worst people are better than
you. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yes, Van Winden.
I sort of think of it, and I know not in the extent of extremity, but I think of it sort of similar to how we would perceive waterboarding, because you wouldn't typically waterboard an American citizen.
Yes, yeah.
You would probably waterboard a spy or somebody who had ill intent towards the country.
That's right. Yeah, the CIA does certain things to non-citizens, and most of us, you know, that's kind of the irony of American politics. We're okay with that as long as it's not one of us.
Our own government did that, don't look around and says,
no, but we're okay if it's somebody. Yeah, I mean, it's still that way today. That's worldly wisdom of any century. There's us and there's them always. And so that's part of it, yeah. So the whole us and them, we're better than them, it was meant to be humiliating. But what else? Even in the word.
Isn't it about power, too?
You know, sure.
We do what, we make the rules, we set the laws, and we govern ourselves by what we set and what we say.
So it's about power. Who has the right to make the world in its own image?
So cruelty.
Cruelty is the point. You know, that Latin base, we still have that word. The word itself, the very name of the thing itself. What does that root mean? Maybe our English word might help you out a little bit. What's it meant to do? Or why do we put that, why is that Latin root in this word with the meaning we give it?
Indescribable suffering.
The humiliation is the point, but so is the pain. Because did Rome want you to fear Rome when Rome did this to somebody?
Excruciating pain.
The point was power and cruelty and humiliation. And you didn't want to wind up being the next guy.
And submission.
Oh, it's submission, that's right. And again, that's part of why Pilate, what does Pilate put on the cross of Jesus? And what's the point of saying that? You know, the Jewish leaders that like it, because they were all called in the religious, you know, about that. But why would Pilate, you know, part of his job description, they're representing Rome, why would Pilate put that up?
Because it showed that he had authority over the kingdom of Israel.
And if anybody else was thinking about declaring themselves to be a Messiah or a king of the Jews, this is what happens to you. You know, and by the way, you know, per, you know, just think about 20th century communism. For most people, is that enough to keep people in line? Think about how, you know, communist states get power over so many people. You know, there always be the couple of rebels who don't mind being martyrs, but for most people, is that going to keep your populace in line?
Sure.
Absolutely.
It's mockery too.
Oh,
because I mean, oh, you guys think you're so great with your faith. Well, look at your king.
Yeah. Absolutely right. And by the way, in the Septuagint translation of Isaiah 29, this goes back to where Paul, verse 18, got the idea of his being destroyed, is what the Greek actually reads. And in the Septuagint version, this is all rendered as, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. God's saying, I'm going to, you know, the wonders I do, I destroy your system of making the world work. And so back to thinking again about the cross, how does it blow up, you know? How does it blow up worldly ways of doing things? Well, think about it. If Rome claims power, like we've just been talking about, power to do this, power of life and death, which is supposedly the ultimate power, right? What's the ultimate penalty a state can inflict upon upon somebody? Death penalty, because that's power. And yet, how does the cross, well, resurrection, as Paul will come back to before the book's over, going back to the power of the cross, let the government take its best shot, and then what does God do 3 days later?
Nullifies
the most fearful, powerful thing Rome has in its toolbox. Think about it. Okay? And so, but what do we live in fear of still?
Death.
Paul knows what he's doing. That's why the book's going to end the way it does. He knows what he's doing. He's going to come back to a subtle aspect of the power of the cross. The song we sing sometimes, was it? No fear, like no fear in death. Was it in Christ alone? What's it, Eric?
No guilt in life, no fear in death.
There it is. Yeah, yeah. No fear in death. You know, this is the power of Christ in me. And so, yeah, so the cross does that. What else does the cross do then? If that's kind of the ultimate way the cross blows up the world's way of running things and the world's systems of power and the world's way of wielding authority on people, you know, then what does it do in terms of how you live? Do you live in a way that your greatest fear is what the state can do to you? What about the apostles? Think about them. If that's all you got? But does that mean suffering's not real? You know, when Paul starts in 2 Corinthians writing about all those beatings and imprisonments and the shipwrecks, does that mean the water wasn't cold? No. But it's perspective. Right? It's perspective. And so the cross begins to empty out the world of all its pretenses about what's really important, about what real power and authority is, about what you live in light of. Because here's the thing, too, then. To whom did God grant this life and this power? Was it to somebody who claimed power or somebody who submitted? Somebody who submitted. And yet, to this day, do we consider submission to be weakness?
Sure.
Think about how feminism dealt with submission in marriage for women. That's a mark of women's weakness. And yet, what the cross says is, maybe not. Maybe submission takes real strength because, first of all, submission implies you have a choice. You could do otherwise. You don't have to choose to submit. It's only a command if you have an option to do otherwise, which means you have some power, you have some agency. So yeah, there's just so much going on there then where this the cross reverses all value systems, all claims, all way of thinking, and ultimately says you've got to look at reality from a different perspective. And again, does that factor in some other things Paul will say in this book? Well, yeah. Think about there in the book. You know, what's the value system by which you evaluate the purpose of gifts? This is the actual context of one of the most famous chapters in the whole book. Love. We always, again, pull that out of context, use it in weddings, or, you know, or Valentine's Day, or just something else. But it sits in the middle, not at the edges, but in the middle of his conversation over you guys are ranking spiritual gifts all wrong. Here's why. You've lost the narrative. You've lost the value system. The cross represents divine love, and therefore you've got to learn to love. And from the value system of love, you will learn how to rank on the basis of what's truly spiritually beneficial, spiritual gifts, and how you use them and how you treat each other and talk about each other and see each other. 1 Corinthians 13 wasn't for Valentine's Day. 1 Corinthians 13 was just simply about giving you an alternative way of relating to God and each other in all manner of spheres, not just in marriage or in your romantic relationships. And so, yeah, you know, there's this alternative because the cross is the ultimate manifestation of divine love. And so it completely reverses, it completely blows up all worldly claims of wisdom. And again, when we hear wisdom, let's just think about what's smart or knowledge. Let's also think about what's right. The way things ought to be that the world thinks it has. It is a completely alternative worldview and value system. Does that make sense? Stop there for a minute. And so the cross confronts all of that. Jesus comes down and he doesn't hold a day job, but he doesn't starve. He doesn't have a place to lay his head down, but he doesn't freeze to death. He simply does what? What is his highest value?
Sir.
And then who first and foremost? God. And because he understands very clearly what the will of the Father is for his life, there's no stress and there's no anxiety, even though he doesn't do anything that you and I do to keep out of stress and anxiety. Because ultimately he understands that the world's contagious value system is not the way the world really works. Think about what he says. You're worried about going naked or going hungry, and yet the plants of the field are better dressed than you are. And the birds of the air, you know, don't starve to death and don't die until God takes notice, and it's God's will that even that sparrow die. And so the old song, his eye is on the sparrow. And that's where that old song we don't sing very often anymore comes from. And that's the whole idea. Yes, they still die, and you're going to die too. But the point is, it's not going to be an accident of time or chance or misfortune. God's got this. And so it's a completely different, you know. And again, did Jesus live that way? Yeah, that's what he meant sometimes when he's saying the Gospels, my hour is not yet come. Doesn't mean he wasn't prudent. He didn't stay in the room when people were picking up rocks. He'd walk away. But the point is, in one sense, he knew he was bulletproof until the hour of the cross come. And then in the Gospels, now the hour's come and my soul is troubled. But what was the whole point? The whole point was he understood that he's not going to die before his time. Again, it doesn't mean he was reckless or foolish. In fact, when Satan says jump, he says, I'm not going to put God to the test. I'm not going to be reckless because I'm bulletproof, at least for a while. That's foolish. But at the same time, he's not going to lose sleep over it because he knows he won't die until his time is up. And again, like we talked about this morning, but I didn't intend for it to dovetail so well. And when God decides your time is up, folks, it doesn't matter whether the doctor gave you a clean bill of health, you know, or how well you were driving because the other guy was drunk and crossed the center line. It's just not going to matter. It's that simple. And so the cross says, don't even worry about the hour of your death. It won't happen until it's supposed to happen, and there's nothing you're going to do about it anyways. Yeah, Randy.
So I want to poke on that concept just for a minute, if
yeah.
I can.
Yeah.
Because I completely agree with what you said, but then when I slide towards the end of Jesus' life, mm-hmm. and when he knows his time is coming, you do see a lot of stress that he is going through at that time.
Yes.
Even though he is doing God's will.
Correct.
Even though he is righteous in God's sight. Even though all of the things are lined up exactly the way God had planned it, he is still in great distress.
Absolutely.
And so there is something to that when we look at our lives and, you know, we try to figure out this thing called life and when is death going to come and people who get sick and don't know what's going on or why or they just die.
Yeah.
You know, and you're trying to make sense of all of that.
Yes.
And when it's you and you've just had that terrible doctor's appointment that just gave you a notice that
6 months.
Six months.
Yeah.
That to me that's the real hard part. Because I look at Jesus and what he went through and the stress that he felt. And yet I'm supposed to sit here and have absolute confidence and faith, which I do, but it doesn't remove the stress of the facing of the event.
Correct. Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think, you know, even just kind of use the rhetoric we've been using, what the cross says to that is that even when that moment or that hour finally comes, as it will come unless Jesus gets here first for all of us, it's not that it's not stressful in one sense, but ultimately, part of what the cross is saying is that the cross-shaped life, again, in a culture that says avoid suffering at all costs, the cross says the way is not around but through.
Right.
And that's, again, a really terrifying, and so that's why words that we don't talk about from the New Testament, endurance, long-suffering, perseverance, those are the words we don't like talking about. I'd rather just, you know,
happy, joy.
That's right. You know, blessed are you in. You know,
exactly.
Whereas, you know, there is this, you know, but, you know, and the irony is that you don't begin to find an actual true joy until you quit trying to avoid suffering. Because part of what robs us of our joy is, I don't think that joy and suffering can coexist. When I wrong, in 2 Corinthians, Paul says the exact opposite. You know, I am despairing and yet at the same time joyful. You know, we are complicated creatures who are capable of doing, having an emotional range, but ironically we don't get that without the maturation that comes with being run over by life and by going through some things and by, you know, like an endurance runner hitting the wall and pushing through rather than hitting the wall and saying I'm done. Not that we really get to choose whether we're done or not. We just get to choose whether we deny things. Yeah, let me work across the room. Go ahead, Sister Baker.
The Bible talks about the even manifestation yearning for the return of him, and that we should be yearning for his return.
It beats dying.
What about that?
I mean, back to Rick's point, it beats dying. You know, and if we remember that, maybe we'd be a little bit more of the Lord come quickly type people rather than I want to go to heaven when I die. Because I think that's exactly right. Now, there was another, is El Vicky.
I'm just reminded of talking to my dad and talking to Les.
Yeah.
And both of them saying the same thing. Why am I still here?
Uh-huh. I know.
And not afraid of moving forward.
Yeah.
And wondering, why am I still here? What is my purpose? And they weren't afraid of the pain or the unknown.
No.
It was time to go.
And that's the mark of a life well lived, by the way, I think, as well, is when you can get to that point and be in that place about it. But yeah, you know, it's funny, you know, when you're young, you think you want to, you know, you don't, because death is this, so when you're young, you don't want to die. You want to live to be 90 or 100 years old. But it's funny, just last month, Amanda and I, when we were up at Fort Worth, we were visiting with her grandfather, who's 102, and he's not happy about it. I've never met somebody who gets to that age and is still glad they're here, I'll be honest. I've never met somebody who's lived that long and is glad they're still here. Maybe there's somebody out there, but I haven't met them yet. I've met some folks who've lived to be aged. I've never met somebody who's that old and is glad they're still alive. Because usually their spouse is dead. Some of their kids may even be dead by that point. All their friends are dead. And almost always by the time you hit that age, you're sitting in a home with somebody else feeding you. I've never met somebody who hits that point in life and says, I'm glad I'm still here. Especially as a Christian.
Great. When Denise's father passed a couple years ago, over the weekend, on Monday, I went to tell my dad, who was like 95, 96 at the time.
He's probably jealous.
No, his response was, well, good for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, you just, you know, I used to joke with your dad that, you know, every generation has to have somebody, the last one out to turn out the lights. Mm-hmm. And apparently God, in his mysterious reasons, your dad's number came up. Yeah, let's get winded and I'll keep on working across the winded.
So I have a slightly different perspective on this, and some of y'all may not be as happy with it. But having worked with a chunk of older individuals, I have found the dark side of that is usually the people that are so ready to go, they stop doing anything to improve their quality of life.
That's
and
right.
That actually, most of the time, you will live both longer and in less pain if you do some of the maintenance things.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that doesn't click with a lot of individuals. And so, yes, you may go sooner if you don't wear the compression socks and you don't do bare minimum walking. I mean, I know this sounds silly, but
no.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
But they may suffer every day for those last few months because they wanted to go and they were convinced it was time to go now.
Yeah.
Or they can make it, even let's say a few more weeks or something, more comfortably and be more productive because they did those bare minimum things.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing for society to grasp for whatever reason. People get into this mentality of, it's time, I know it's time, and it's like, that's not you or I. Call.
That's right. No, that's right. And that's the thing, John. When we're younger, we want to have control over not dying too young. When we're older, you know, sometimes we get to a point where we wish we had more control over. And of course, you know, that's ironic. You know, this big move towards euthanasia in a lot of countries. We just want power over this stuff. And so, you know, I get to a certain age, and then when I decide my quality of life isn't worth it, you know, I will take a drastic step, like, you know, going to the Netherlands and taking the shot. But we don't like the fact that the crowbar, what the cross says is, you're not in control. You submit to God's plan, God's design. It's not always fair or just in this life, because the crucifixion was one of the greatest miscarriages of justice ever. But it was the will of God, and so you submit to it. And that's just hard for us to accept. That the cross is a form of passivity in the face of the world's wickedness. But the passivity of I do what's right, not changing what I do because of the world's consequences or the world's values, what the world says is good, I should desire. You know, I should desire the big house, I should desire the big title, I should desire the big paycheck, I should desire the prestige and esteem. You know, that's why, how I make decisions or whatever it is. Yeah, Anthony.
I was just thinking about the whole thing of Christ and the suffering and the agony that he went through and everything, but it's good that we did see all of that, because the final thing was, okay, I'm ready.
Yeah.
Got that out, and then your will be done.
Yeah.
And went on. So that's the crowning of that whole process that went through. He was human.
Yeah.
And he showed that human side.
Absolutely.
But the final thing is, I'm ready.
Yeah, that's right. You know, even though my will is very human in this moment, facing what I'm facing, thy will be done.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part too. Again, you know, part of what the way of the cross says, because you're right, I think this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Randy. What the way of the cross teaches all of us is that there come moments in our lives, and you know, none of us get to decide when or how many of them there will be. But all of us will hit, you know, if you're a serious follower of Jesus, there will be moments when you have to do this, your own personal Gethsemane, your own wrestling in the garden, where you choose submission and passivity to consequences, because you're simply going to do what's right and follow the way of the cross in that regard. And recognize that it's not your place to choose based on the desired results. It's your place to choose based upon what's right before God and what glorifies God and what reflects God's values rather than the world's. And so all of us, you know, hit those dark moments when we have to make those kind of decisions, you know, sooner or later.
Jeff, and sometimes, you know, what Wyndon has said, people lay there and they're ready to go.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, but God has a sense of humor. We often hear that. He may decide to, like, prolong it for another 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and then a person just, they see what's going on. Well, I guess I decided to get up from here and live.
Yeah.
And live life.
Yeah.
And try to grab back or redeem the time that they've wasted or lost.
Yeah. Well, and my part of it too is, you know, we don't really know what God's up to in our lives, you know, why I'm here, you know, even, you know, so.
Well, RJ's a perfect example of that. I mean, he was on life support, and they decide they're going to take him off life support. He's like, no, 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 it's not time yet.
Yeah.
And then he falls off the ladder. I mean.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, I know.
Every time I think of that story, I'm like, wow, that's a perfect example of when God's ready, he's ready.
No. You know, there's that line in the Psalms about, you know, before I was born, my days were written in your book, O Lord. So there it is. You know, you may not know your dates, but God does. So, all right. So, man, there's a lot there in that statement of Paul's in there. There's a whole. It's a symbol. You know, just like, you know, that's why people, you know, when people burn the American flag, and we go, ah, why? Because it's not just about burning a piece of fabric. The flag is a symbol of a whole worldview and value system. That's why people get upset about that. You know, the cross is that in the Bible. It is not just a thing or an event. It is a symbol for an entire mindset and value system. And that's what Paul is trying to get back in front of the Corinthians. And so he reminds them of you know, exactly what Isaiah was teaming up there, that God intended in the way he runs the world, the cross being the foremost example, but even back in Isaiah's day when an angel will wipe out, you know, wipe out the Syrian army for the man who trusted, whereas the other guys, you know, worried about, you know, writing a check to Egypt to bail them out. The point is, God will do wonders that blow up the world's value system for those with eyes to see. And in so doing, God destroys the wisdom of the wise and the discernment of the discerning. You know, all those experts that they put on the talk shows. You know, you realize how raw, I mean, you know, we joke about the weatherman is the chief example, right? You know, we're laughing because how many of us, you know, didn't have the umbrella because we were told it wasn't going to rain, or we took the umbrella like a fool because we were told it wasn't, it didn't. You've been there, you know? And so, but how many other spheres, think about, you know, the economic experts. How many of you have lost money in the market because you followed, I was going to mention names, I won't. Somebody on, you know, CNBC or MSN, you know, how many of you lost money in the market because you followed a can't-miss pick? Even Warren Buffett sometimes, you know, misses, yeah? Yeah. And so there it is. You know, how many political experts? Oh, you know. And again, I'm not saying what should be, I'm talking about what did happen. You remember when we all were assured, we were assured by the experts Hillary Clinton was going to win and Donald Trump didn't have a chance. You remember that? Wow. And by the way, there's nothing new about that kind of thing happening. I remember when that famous picture of Truman holding up the Dewey Wins headline newspaper? Because all the experts back, you know, decades ago, Truman will never win re-election. And then he does, he's holding up. But back in those days, there wasn't the internet where you could bury the past on a memory hole like 1984. You know, they'd already printed, and there's... That cost money back then, folks, but the smart people, the media, was so confident that Truman was done, they'd already buried him.
Y2K.
Yeah. And so there it is. And how much money was spent?
Huge amount of money.
Yeah, because you worked in tech. You would know. You saw it. Probably profit numbers like that. I'm sorry. But no, that's, you know, all the smart people say. You know, and all we have to do is go bury, you know, going through the archives of the newspapers and the magazines. Don't get me started about academia. And what, I mean, in my field, literally the turn of the 20th century, we joke about it now, even though nobody's fallen back on their knees and confessed God, but the assured results of critical scholarship, and these are theories and ideas that even modern skeptics laugh at now and say, boy, that was really weak. Oh, the assured results of critical scholarship on the Bible. And so it goes. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of the age? We would call those the experts today. All the people with letters after their names, talking heads on TV. Where are these folks? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. Now, stop right there. What is he saying in that phrase? What's he saying? In the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. This is an important idea. What's he saying? That was the first bell, right?
But they didn't submit.
They didn't submit. But part of why they don't submit, there's a lot of reasons why they don't submit.
So you don't know God through the world's wisdom.
Okay.
It's like God, God made it that way. God made it that way. But then they don't know. They can't see and they can't hear.
So when world's wisdom kicks in, what kind of gods do you get? Can I introduce you to the Greek and Roman gods?
All kinds.
Yeah, you get all kinds, and you get Greek and Roman gods, who are basically what you wish you had the power to do and get away with. Zeus got to sleep with lots of women, you know, and then on it goes. And that's what you get when we do it. And so God says, yo, who is like me? What will you compare me? And so anyways, we got to stop there. We'll pick up next week. This is what we